I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Holocaust survivor and author Ernest Michel, who reported on the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial and has had a fascinating and inspirational life. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking about the nature of Jewish life in America and how it has changed in recent decades. When I was growing up, say 40 years ago, the fixtures of American Jewish life were the synagogue, conservative, reformer, orthodox, take your pick, Jewish community centers, non-denominational, but Jewish culturally, and I guess athletically, and Israel-oriented organizations like B'nai B'rith and Hadassah and the Histadrut and the Pioneer Women. There were subsets of all of these, like the sisterhood and men's clubs and youth groups at synagogues, B'nai B'rith women, and so on, and there were other institutions that were critical for some of the year or for some sectors of the community, Jewish camps for the young, Jewish day schools, but just for Orthodox kids, Hillel for college kids, and Jewish old age homes for the elderly. And, of course, there were Jewish hospitals, although they were open to everybody. But in essence, the synagogues, JCCs, and Israel organizations were the pillars of diaspora life. Jews were very active in charitable work for social good, but often they chose in those days to do this through Jewish charities, feeding the Jewish hungry, caring for the Jewish underprivileged, Jewish family services for broken families or counseling children, scholarships to higher education for underprivileged Jewish students, building hospitals or orphanages, but in Israel through Jewish organizations. Jews cared about Jewish causes very much. They also cared about society as a whole, of course, but they knew that they had to help Jewish causes because nobody else would. It was a primary responsibility, and we all knew that. This Jewish community infrastructure was created and supported by the fundraising undertaken by the organizations themselves, sometimes with assistance from the United Jewish Appeal, now the Jewish Federation Movement, which mostly raised money for Israel and gave some to local causes. But most of those organizations did their fundraising by themselves with donations and bequests. The Jewish community in those days was much less affluent than it is today, that is, less affluent, and it was mostly the children of first-generation immigrants from Europe. Anti-Semitism was a serious problem. The survival of Israel was the principal concern of most American Jews of every denomination or movement. And there were new causes from time to time, bringing the Russian Jews out and so on, saving Ethiopian Jews eventually. Conservative rabbis came from only one seminary, Reform rabbis from one of two campuses of the same seminary, Orthodox rabbis came from wherever Orthodox rabbis still come from, and that was about it. There was lots of disagreement within the Jewish world, of course. Some things don't change at all, but that rough organization of the Jewish reality is what prevailed. Now, fast forward 40 years or so to today. Things have changed. However, in spite of many efforts to declare them irrelevant, past their prime, dated out of touch, etc., and to replace them with something shiny and new, the primary Jewish organizations, synagogues, JCCs, and Israel organizations are still around, but in somewhat different forms. Synagogues, or temples, or congregations provide an array of services besides prayers, religious school, and life cycle. There are preschools, adult education, counseling, social action programming, youth groups, community advocacy, and Israel programming. JCCs, which nearly disappeared under the competition from newer health clubs and sports facilities, have made a comeback in part by welcoming non-Jewish members in larger and larger numbers and on days when they used to be closed. Israel is a well-established fact, and the pro-Israel organizations have now turned to political action, AIPAC or its newer competitor J Street, and to supporting specific kinds of political or social programs in Israel or the U.S. Jewish organizations that targeted smaller niche needs like retirement homes or counseling and social work services continue to exist. Some have grown more focused and effective, some less so. As so often happens, the need-based charitable organizations that were started to solve Jewish communal problems often morphed into permanent entities that now raise money and cater to many non-Jews. And the Federation system, founded to raise money for Israel and for local Jewish causes, has struggled over the years and then come out of it. It has become in some communities an end in itself, providing programming that actually competes with synagogues and other Jewish entities in the interests of creating allegiances that will result in greater dollars being given through the Federation process. And new organizations and programs designed to reach and slightly involve not very committed Jews to seek to create an amorphous reason to be kind of a little Jewish, you know, not too Jewish, these seem to be popping up all the time. But perhaps most importantly, Jews no longer think of Jewish activities, community, and causes first. We remain hugely active in charities and in the community and give at a very high level, just not necessarily for or to Jewish causes. Universities and arts programs and social action causes and political involvement often come before Jewish identity. And while the current wisdom says that our American Jewish community population is stable at around 6 million Jews, there is no sense that it is deepening in commitment or activity in a Jewish way, at least outside of the Orthodox sector. All of which makes this a very interesting time to be a Jewish professional, that is, you know, a rabbi, or to have a Jewish radio show. And yet Judaism has so much to offer our world today, so much meaning and purpose. You know, I don't have a crystal ball. As Isaiah said, I am not a prophet or the son of a prophet, although I am a rabbi and the son of a rabbi and the grandson of a rabbi. But I do know that there is nothing more interesting, challenging, and exciting than living a committed Jewish life. And so to play us in, here's Doug Kotler singing Jewish USA for our community in transition.
If everybody had a Torah across the USA, then everybody'd be Jewish like you and me today. You'd see them wearing a tallit in shul on Saturday. If everybody was Jewish, Jewish USA. You'd see a Jew in the White House and in the NBA, racing into 500, running the NRA. There'd be no more races and no more KKK.
Jewish USA.
We'd all be singing Hot Chick-fil-A at every baseball game. The D.A.R. and Adasa, they'd both be the same. And even Pat Buchanan would want to change his name. If everybody was Jewish, Jewish USA. The Easter Bunny and Santa would have a holiday. No ham and cheese on white bread with lots of mayonnaise. And the spirit of Jaga would be the latest craze.
Jewish USA.
That was Doug Kotler's Jewish USA. Ernest Michel was a young man when he was taken into a labor camp just before World War II. He eventually survived Auschwitz and three other concentration camps, and with just a grade school education became a reporter at the Nuremberg trials in Germany, in German, just after the war. His story and his subsequent career are fascinating. He He's a great guy. Hear how it all happened to him when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
The other day, I was at a business networking breakfast, and I introduced myself to the fella sitting next to me by saying, "Hi, Joe Spina, of Mama's Pizza." Without missing a beat, he said, "I know, you're the, now repeat after me guy." Well, it was clear he'd heard my commercials before, but the guy sitting next to us was a little puzzled. Obviously, he had no idea who I was. So I tried a little experiment. I asked the first guy to tell the second guy what he knew about Mama's just from hearing our commercials. "Easy," he said. "Mama's is a family-run restaurant that's been around Tucson a long time. One of the things they have is a huge pizza called the Family Size. Oh, and they pride themselves on having great atmosphere and value." So there, in about 10 seconds, this guy who had never heard of Mama's before basically knew the whole story. And now, so do you. Except that we have four convenient locations in Tucson. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Ernest Michel is a Holocaust survivor who in November of 1945, at the ripe age of 22 years, just after 5.5 years in Nazi concentration camps, served as a special correspondent for the German news agency DANA. He reported on the Nuremberg war crimes trial as, under the byline, special correspondent Ernst W. Michel, Auschwitz survivor 104995. His story is a fascinating one, and his life that followed also extraordinarily interesting. We welcome to Too Jewish this morning our guest, Ernest Michel. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
It's an honor to speak to you, sir. Tell us a little bit about, in this year in which there's been so many commemorations of the Nuremberg trials, tell us a little bit about how you ended up as a correspondent at Nuremberg.
Well, it's a fascinating story. I was an inmate in Auschwitz, and at the end of the war, I became a correspondent for the German news agency at the Nuremberg war crimes trial. I covered the trial from November 1945 until 1946, in other words, about 6 or 7 months. And I was the only survivor who covered the trial from almost from beginning to end. It was a fluke. I was 16 years old. I'd been kicked out of school in sixth grade, never went back to school again. But the American lieutenant who worked with me after I had escaped from the camp called an American newsman and told him that you might want to be interested in calling somebody from the camp who was a Holocaust survivor. That's how it came about. I had a sixth grade public education. I never went back to school again after I was arrested. And then I became, in 1945, right after the war was over, I became a correspondent for the German news agency. And my letter, my reports were covered all over Germany. And also interesting is the fact that the defendants were only allowed German newspapers. from growing on. And it became a fascinating event for me, probably one of the most important ones of my career.
Boy, it must be both fascinating and really weird to think that all this Nazi hierarchy was reading your reports on their trial. We will talk much more with Ernest Michel, whose book is called, by the way, Promises Kept, One Man's Journey Against Incredible Odds, about his survival and his career thereafter, and a little bit more about Nuremberg when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Temple Emanuel, Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with Rabbi Sam Kohan is set May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you're interested in going with me on this great journey to Israel, email twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and to sign up. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So, Iran comes up again and again in the news, and there's speculation as to how soon they might have a nuclear capability, and will Israel attack? Are they going to attack in concert with the United States? Is it going to be in a year or 2 years or 3 years? Is it going to happen next week? Awful lot of noise. Ehud Barak says it's not happening anytime soon. Should we believe him? He's the defense minister.
Well, you know, I believe all... Every politician I hear, I always believe all of them. Yeah, right. I must tell you that from my perspective, Iran is a major issue, not only for Israel. I believe that Arab nations around Israel are by far more concerned by Iran than Israel is. At the end of the day, Israel... probably have ways to defend itself, but once Iran will gain nuclear capability, that will give Iran a lot of political power within the Arab world, and that will influence the whole new regimes that are now emerging in the Middle East. We need to remember that all in all, in the Arab world, we're talking about over 400 million Arabs. We're talking about an area of land that is bigger than the size of the United States. We're talking about control over more than 30% of the world's oil. And Iran is visioning a situation that by gaining nuclear power, Iran will gain political and diplomatical power over this region and will become the leader of an emerging superpower that will lead a fundamentalistic, extreme ideology. And I think that's a threat to the entire world. And I definitely think that's something that the Western world should refer to very seriously.
So in addition to thinking about it very seriously, not that you were ever involved in intelligence work or anything, but it does seem like Israel has been taking steps steadily, and the United States has been very strong in supporting, or at least in supporting the international pressures and in quietly approving or certainly not contradicting some of the things Israel has done behind the scenes. Are they working closely in concert, do you think?
I believe so, but to be honest, I think the United States could do by far more, even without getting to the point of military invasion to Iran.
Right.
You know, the United States could come and say, any company that does any business with Iran is not welcome here anymore. That will have a lot of pressure on Iran. One thing that most Americans are not aware that despite the fact that Iran gets oil from the ground and sells oil to the world, it doesn't have a lot of refineries. So it actually ends up buying gasoline from other countries.
Isn't that ironic?
It is, but it's a lot of power to the Western world. You could say, you know what? I'm not selling you any more gasoline. If an airline wants to fly to Iran, they can't fly to the United States. If an insurance company wants to work with an Iranian company, they can't work in the United States. That's a lot of power, and that could help stop the Iranian from continuing this agenda of gaining nuclear weapons.
Excellent points. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night, or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You just came back not too long ago from a trip to Bulgaria. You were tasting wines for one of your many jobs in this world and found a very large cache of kosher wines that the winemaker couldn't sell. Let's talk a little bit about what makes a wine kosher.
Right. Well, in this guy's view, what makes a wine kosher is having a large group of people he thought of as rabbis supervising every aspect of the process, from crushing and fermentation to bottling and even labeling the bottles. And he had a rather interesting view of what the requirements of these people were, which included praying in a tent with open flaps so that they could only be there in nice weather.
Yeah, it's not exactly how it normally works.
Right, since we've all been in synagogues and temples that don't have open flaps and aren't tents, we know that even for the most Orthodox people, that's not exactly necessary. But this guy had become convinced of that. What was a mystery to him is, what other than the presence of a large number of rabbis, in his view, in my knowledge, it's only like one person who's a mashgiach, who doesn't have to be a rabbi and doesn't even have to be a man, as far as I know, supervising certain aspects of the process. And I'm sure
there's a little
more of the halakha than I do.
Yeah, there's a little more to it than that. And it's not just sort of what it says in Talmud. Basically, how can wine not be kosher? It's just crushed grapes that are fermented. But there are a number of different issues in the clarification of wine. They use certain chemicals. Some of those are actually meat products. And the filtration of wine, particularly in France, they used to use certain kinds of animal membranes to filter out the must so that they could have a clearer wine. And those would also invalidate whether a wine could be drunk by Jews who were strictly kosher. And then the most complicated and least pleasant to talk about is the notion that if a non-Jew handles the wine before it's sealed in the bottle, or even after it's opened, then it somehow can be impure. And this is only for people who are really strictly kosher, following this idea, because they might have then been considered for sacramental purposes, for other religious purposes, or for pagan worship or something. So that's the general understanding, which means that if you're really super kosher, then you only drink wine that's called mevushal. It's literally boiled. It's heated to kind of a flash pasteurization point, and that it makes it okay to use, and it's then sealed in the bottle, and then it could be opened by somebody Jewish and you're fine. Some winemakers think that this mevushal ruins the good wines. A lot of winemakers, and actually a lot of wine experts, enologists, don't agree that it ruins, does anything particularly damaging to the wine. So there's a reasonably healthy debate about that. But making a wine kosher is more complicated than you would think. Of course, it's Jewish, so naturally it'll be more complicated than you think. But to find somebody in Bulgaria trying to create kosher wine because he sees this as a really important market is stunning to me still.
Well, he's got quite a few thousands of cases of kosher wines on his hand. So
were they any good?
If anybody wants to help him out.
Yeah, if they're really good, maybe you could just send him to 2 Jewish Radio and we'll see if we can give him away, as kind of
deduction. One of his two best wines, actually, he does make with a kosher label. And if he, in fact, made it the same way, I didn't taste the wine with the kosher label because he explained that a non-Jew wasn't allowed to open it. But the wines that I tasted in that winery were really excellent and among the best of the whole trip.
Well, that's terrific. Maybe what he would like to do is unload that wine on us. We can use it for Purim, which is coming up soon.
That'd be great.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Moshe went for his annual physical. "I hate to be the one to break it to you," said the doctor, "but you've only got 6 months to live." "Oh my God," gasped Moshe, turning white. As the news sunk in, he asked, "Doctor, you've known me a long time. Do you have any suggestions as to how I could make the most of my remaining months?" "Well," asked the doctor, "have you ever married?" Moshe replied he'd been a bachelor his whole life. "You might think about taking a wife," said the doctor. "That's a good idea," said Moshe. "With only 6 months to live, I better make the most of my remaining time." "Can I make one more suggestion?" asked the doctor. "Marry a Jewish woman." "A Jewish woman?" Moshe said. "Why?" "It'll seem longer." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Make it seem as long as possible. In a mitzvah that's at the heart of the Jewish religious experience today, God commands the Israelites in this week's portion of Truma, "Asu li mikdash v'shachanti betocham," make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell among you. With this statement, the book of Exodus moves from practical laws to ritual ones. The plans for the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, first site of national worship, and the directions for building an Ark of the Covenant are explained in detail. In order to create the new central shrine for prayer, the place which God's presence will actually inhabit, Moses calls on the people of Israel to donate materials from the best of what they have, what comes to be called a truma offering. And a remarkable thing happens. When the people are asked to donate gifts to build this holy structure needed to worship God, they come forward immediately and give much more than is required. Moses actually has to ask the Israelites, to stop bringing so much gold and silver and so many precious fabrics. This marks the first and only time in history when a temple building campaign brought in more than was asked for. May it happen again sometime soon. In any case, the word for this experience is truma, the free will offering, a gift to God given out of the goodness of the heart. This generous offering is a powerful thing. When it is constructed, the tabernacle in the wilderness, built from free generosity, immediately fills with God's presence. And so today, when we give freely of ourselves to our temples, in time, love, care, or funds, we seek to recreate this truma, this free will offering, the full gift of heart and hand of our ancestors in Moses' time. When we succeed in doing so, we too can bring God's presence and love into our lives. But more than that, when we give freely to those around us, the real truma offering, not just ritually but personally, well, then God comes there too. The great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai wrote beautifully and sensuously on the subject of the synagogue in his final book, Open, Closed, Open. I studied love in the sanctuary of my childhood. I sang Come, Sabbath Bride, on Friday nights with a bridegroom's fervor. I practiced longing for the days of the Messiah. I conducted yearning drills for the days of yore that will not return. The cantor serenades his love out of the depths. Kaddish is recited over lovers who stay together. The male bird dresses up in a blaze of color. And we dress the rolled-up Torah scrolls in silken petticoats and gowns of embroidered velvet held up by narrow shoulder straps. And we kiss them as they are passed around the synagogue, stroking them as they pass, as we pass. Like Yehuda Amichai, may we find love of God and holiness in our own temple sanctuary and in our lives. When we come back, Ernest Michel will continue his incredible story of survival and of testimony, and then the wonderful life he's led since coming out of Auschwitz and the Nuremberg trials as a Federation executive for many, many decades. All that when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu, aseinu, aleinu, aleinu.
Two Israeli diplomats were targeted last week in simultaneous bomb plots that were blamed on Iran. A bomb attached magnetically to a car in the Indian capital of New Delhi exploded, injuring the wife of an Israeli official and two bystanders. That diplomat's wife, Tal Yehoshua Koren, is recovering. And officials in Georgia, the former Soviet republic, not the U.S. state that has Atlanta in it, said an explosive device was attached to the bottom of a diplomat's car in the capital, Tbilisi, but it was found and defused before it detonated. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Iran was behind both incidents, adding that the Islamic Republic's Lebanese ally Hezbollah, which battled Israel in a month-long war in 2006, may have also been involved. In addition, a botched bombing plot in Thailand aimed at Israeli diplomats ended when the Iranian attacker threw a grenade that bounced back and blew off his own legs. These sort of coordinated attacks seem to have been designed as payback from Iran for Israel's targeted efforts to halt Iran's attempts to create a nuclear weapon. In happier news, Apple is expected to incorporate technology from Israeli startup Anobit into its iPad 3, which will be released in early March. Anobit's flash memory technology was used in the iPad 2. Last month, Apple admitted that it had indeed acquired the startup, its first Israeli acquisition. Anobit's chip is responsible for making gadgets faster by enhancing flash drive performance through signal processing. It has been used in products including the iPhone and the MacBook Air. The iPad 3 will be expected to be even faster than its predecessor, thanks to Israeli help. And two final stories illustrate that apparently commercial enterprise knows no limits. First, the Western Wall Heritage Foundation last week lodged an official police complaint after a fraudulent solicitation appeared on eBay offering stones from the Kotel, the holiest Jewish site in the world, for good luck and blessing. Rabbi Shmuel Rabinovich, chairman of the foundation, the presiding authority of the Kotel, the Western Wall, was notified of the matter by Jews who saw the entry on eBay and found it to be sacrilegious. Yes, one would assume they weren't selling those Herodian stones at the bottom that weigh about, 3,000 pounds each. Rabinovich contacted eBay and asked that the entry be removed. He termed the sale and use of stones from the Western Wall a sacrilege explicitly forbidden in the Torah and a violation of modern antiquities law. Nonetheless, the Western Wall Jerusalem blessing stones are still apparently for sale, $4.99 apiece, but $9.99 for shipping. Five stones have apparently been sold so far, according to eBay. And you thought it was bad when Schnorrers solicited you for a charitable donation when you walked towards the wall to pray. Now they're selling the very rocks. And second story, a hand-me-down from an anonymous Hasidic teen was the inspiration behind the Crown Prince of England's wife's Kate Middleton's wardrobe. The coat most famously worn by the UK's Queen-to-be was modeled after a jacket sewn for a religious boy from Jerusalem. The designer behind Middleton's favorite label, Catherine Hooker, has become the darling of the fashion world practically overnight. It began with a fortuitous visit to Israel over a decade ago. You see, you should go to Israel. Hooker told New York Magazine last month her successful label was inspired by an item she picked up at a secondhand store. "I bought a young boy's Hasidic coat in a junk shop," she said. "It was an old one, like when clothes used to be made for people by hand as opposed to mass market. I was 18 and tiny and skinny, and it fit me absolutely perfectly. It was made for a 14-year-old boy." According to the report, Hooker loved the coat so much she found a tailor in India who replicated it for her. The jacket grew popular among her friends. After making more duplicates, she opened her own shop in London, 2004. Middleton and her sister Pippa soon became patrons of the establishment, and the rest is fashion history. In addition to the Middleton sisters, this store is now frequented by Princesses Eugenie and Beatrice, as well as a dozen other members of the royal family. The shtetl tailor, who was behind the original kapota's design, would be maybe a little shocked to find out that his creation is the muse behind items that sell for over $1,500 each. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Ernest Michel wrote the book Promises Kept, One Man's Journey Against Incredible Odds, but in 1945. He served as a correspondent for German language newspapers on the Holocaust. He survived 5.5 years in camps. Both he and his sister survived the Holocaust, although their parents were both murdered by the Nazis. I'd like you to talk just a little bit about something you say early in your book, maybe even in the kind of the foreword. Your parents, you say, passed away in 1942, killed in Auschwitz, where you were also an inmate. They never knew that you and your sister Lottie would survive. How many descendants did the two of you have combined?
Well, the only one was my sister, who was able to get to France before the war broke out. And eventually, I lost track of her. And at the end of the war, after 6 years of the camps, I finally tried to find my sister, but there was absolutely no record there. And I assumed I was the only person of our family who was alive.
So you didn't see Lottie again until when?
Well, actually, it was an amazing incident, because the American lieutenant with whom I worked in Mannheim, which is my hometown, he came to me and he said, look, I have somebody here from Palestine that was before Israel was created. And I told him that you are a survivor and you lost your daughter, or rather your sister. Mm-hmm. And that man brought letters from Palestine into Germany to see whether some people could be found. And the American lieutenant introduced me to him, and he said, look, I understand you lost your sister. What's your name? Ernest Michel. Well, I have a letter here to you. He says, it's impossible. My sister died. Says, well, here is a letter, Ernest Michel Mannheim, from Lotte Michel in Palestine. And that turned out to be my sister. It was an amazing, unbelievable event when I found out that my sister had survived as well. She was kept in a convent in France by Catholic nuns and eventually sent over the Pyrenean Mountains into Palestine, and survived the war. And if I can tell you one thing that I'm very proud of, although I have nothing to do with it, my sister is today living in the same kibbutz that they founded before Israel became a state.
Wow.
And she survived and in Palestine, and that's how I found her, because of a letter written from her to among the many letters that he carried. And I was, I don't have to tell you how proud I was. Today, my sister has 30 great-grandchildren.
Oh, my.
and make really, up for what we lost.
Yeah, phenomenal.
You know, there's a story that you tell in your book, you know, not very long, frankly, when President Eisenhower was in the White House, you ended up going to the White House with Senator Jacob Javits of blessed memory and meeting him. And you write about how in your wildest dreams in Auschwitz and Buchenwald could you possibly have imagined that you would meet, you know, the most powerful person in the world to represent everything about the Americans who came and eventually liberated you?
Well, it happened very quickly. We were invited by the president to visit him as a group of survivors, because I happened, together with Norbert Wollheim, another survivor, organized the first Auschwitz dinner in the United States. It had about 600 people from all over the country who came to that. And Javits arranged a meeting for us with the president of the United States a few days later. And a small group of us, about six men, were able to meet the president at the White House in his room. And it was an event that I've never forgotten. And they wrote a story, and the title was called The Day I Met the President. It was an unbelievable experience. It was the first time that the president met survivors.
Boy, you know, you talk about how your fellow survivor who was there put a yarmulke on and asked Eisenhower to say a prayer.
Yes, I was embarrassed. I think, how can he do that?
To the President of the United States.
To ask the President of the United States. But he did. He was a very religious individual. He was the one who originated this event, you know. And he and I were the two spokesmen. I've never forgotten Norbert. Norbert was a wonderful, wonderful guy. He was responsible for the fact that we, survivors from Auschwitz, were able to get some money from IG Farben, which built a factory in Auschwitz, and we were responsible for building it.
Tell us a little bit about the course of your experience. You were captured by the Nazis just before the war.
I was sent, when I was 16 years old, to my first camp, a forced labor camp that was after the war. And I spent the first 2 or 3 years in various labor camps. There were no, this was before the gas chambers. And then the gas chambers were built, and the first one that I went to was Auschwitz in 1943. My parents were sent to Auschwitz the year before. I only learned that later on. That I survived it is a miracle, because let me just only briefly will tell you, I was hurt by one of the SS men, and I had to go to the infirmary. There were no hospitals in Auschwitz, obviously. And my father forced me before the war, after I was kicked out of school, to learn calligraphy. And that saved my life. I had to write every day. It's a long story, I'll make it short. The Körperschwäche und Herzanschlag, that's heart attack and weak of body. Nobody ever died in Auschwitz in the camps of being gassed. They all died normal death, Körperschwäche and Herzanschlag. And that I wrote, and that actually saved my life. Had it not been for that, you wouldn't be able to hear me today.
And as you said, you happened to have studied calligraphy at home, or at least that's what you told the Nazi doctors, and that saved your life in Auschwitz.
That is correct. That is correct.
When you came to the United States, obviously after the war, after liberation, after the Nuremberg trials, what was your experience like?
Well, first of all, I had any number of offers to stay in Germany. I met at a reception with the incoming president of Germany. I forgot his name.
Konrad Adenauer was his name.
Adenauer, that's the name. And he talked to me and said, look, you are probably among the first people who are Jews who are back in Germany and take a role here. And I hope you will stay in Germany. I had to make up my mind what to do. I had an offer, but I don't think I wanted to stay in Germany. But it was tempting. But eventually I then came to the United States and began a career. I started to work for the United Jewish Appeal. And I've been with UJA now for 63 years.
Only 63 years.
Only 63 years. It's the only job I ever had, because in the camp I felt I wanted to tell the story of what happened. And I've been doing this ever since. As a matter of fact, last night, I'm now in Arizona for a few weeks with my wife, and I was asked to speak to teachers who who are learning about the Holocaust. So I've maintained that all my life. I felt it was an obligation that I had, and I was very proud to be able to continue to do that.
So I want you to talk a little bit about something I think very entertaining. When you first came to America, you decided that what you wanted to do was find the first restaurant you could and order what you had wanted for the whole period of the war. Go ahead. Could you tell us what it was?
Yeah. We arrived in New York through the UJA, affidavit, and I was given a room with another friend, a survivor, in New York. And I had $10 in my pocket. That's all was given to me by the JDC. And with that $10, I wanted to go to a restaurant. I'd never been to a restaurant before, obviously in Germany. And beautiful white clothing, you know, white desk and so forth.
Tablecloths and fancy waiters and everything,
and
right?
And the guy asked me, the waiter came, says, "What do you want?" He says, "Well, I want some whipped cream." For $10, that's all I have. He says, "What do you mean, it's whipped cream? How, you speak with an accent." "Well, I just came today from Europe. I'm a survivor." "You are? Well, you sit there right now." And he came with three pieces of pie and whipped cream.
All over.
That's the first time I ever had it. In my life, and that was the beginning of my life here in the United States.
It's a fantastic story. I want to thank Ernest Michel for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His book is called Promises Kept, One Man's Journey Against Incredible Odds, and his life story is just fantastic. Speaks to all kinds of educational groups about his experience. Thank you so much for a terrific visit.
Well, and thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Deborah Feldman, author of the controversial new book, Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots, a memoir. Really interesting interview. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on our TooJewishRadio.com website. And like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from a jazzy vishamru from the Shalshelet Jewish Music Festival, sung by a choir and Susan Collin. My friends, may you be blessed with a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.